This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. And today, as part of a series of conversations I've been having with people who were editors and publishers of literary magazines and presses, I'm talking to Bill Mohr, M-O-H-R, who was in Los Angeles then, and I think now you're in Long Beach, but you still are identified, I think, in this kind of Los Angeles poetry scene, and it's really good to have a chance to talk to you.
I'm very happy that you asked me to be part of this project, David. It's great to connect with you again.
Yeah.
You were part of that history, you know.
Well, that's part of the impetus for me in wanting to have these conversations is that, you know, I have these, you know, these roots and connections with people like you that mean a lot to me. So maybe you should talk a little bit about, you know, we'll identify you as the founder and editor of Momentum Magazine. It was also later to become Momentum Press. And this is all starting in the 70s, but maybe you could talk a little bit about kind of the beginning for you, how you came to poetry, when you started writing, where were you situated in the early 70s?
Well, my journey to poetry is sort of interwoven with my shift as a teenager away from a very conservative upbringing that I had. My father was a career enlisted man in the U.S. Navy, and I was raised in a very strict Catholic household and politically conservative household, distinctly to the right of Barry Goldwater would be the best way of describing it. And when I was just after I finished high school, by chance, I acted in a play, one of Tennessee Williams' plays. I played the role of Tom, and the poetry, the prose poetry of Tennessee Williams began to sort of break up this spiritual iceberg that was embedded inside me. And over the next couple years, when I went away to college, I started doing a lot of reading, especially of theater. And was mainly interested in a theater at first, although I had a French teacher that really turned me on to some really terrific poetry, and not just French poetry. So by the time I was in my early 20s, I was really interested in both theater and poetry, and I moved to UCLA. I was a theater major, actually, and when I got out of there, I looked around for theater companies. And I did some acting. But by chance, one day I showed up at Papa Bach Bookstore, which was one of the best independent bookstores with a great poetry selection. And I read at a poetry reading, and the owner asked me to be the poetry editor for a magazine he was started. And I just sort of took off from there. I liked doing it so much that after two issues, I ended up deciding to start my own magazine, which would be devoted only to poetry. Bakke published fiction and photographs and other things. So I just wanted a poetry magazine because there just seemed to be so many poets in the city that I thought deserved an audience, deserved to see their work in print. It was a weird happening in a way in that I was younger than almost all these other poets. I never went to graduate school until I was 50 when I went back to school to get a PhD, which is to say I never got an MFA. I had a BA in theater arts, and I sort of threw myself into a really vibrant underground art scene in LA in the early 70s and met all these older poets who mentored me and talk poetry. I didn't see any need to go get an MFA. I already had individuals who were more than willing to help me learn about the art and craft. And I, in turn, busted my ass to get their work into print. So sort of that was the tuition. So that's what really started the magazine, was just simply being so excited about the work that I saw around me, that I just couldn't help but become involved and committed to it. And so I started the magazine, and within a year, I saw that there was a need to get books out, and that books would last longer than any issue of a magazine. I mean, that magazine comes out and people read it for a few months and then they're wondering where the next issue is. Whereas a book can be on the shelf and people will find it over a period of 2 or 3 or 4 years. And so by the late 70s, I was much more committed to putting out books. And I was really lucky in being in LA because there were a lot of independent stores that would stock my books. And not only that, many of them would actually even pay me up front. I mean, I'd bring the books and they would give me the cash right then. They wouldn't wait till it had sold. So, and it did sell. And then they would call and say, bring some more copies in. So that was, that's how really sort of extraordinary a scene it was, really flourishing. And, but of course, the big question is how do you get distribution outside of the area that you can physically bring the books to yourself? And that's where the question of distribution came in. And in fact, left David Wilk and Truck and other enterprises that you had. I think I remember it correctly. Wasn't it called Truck?
Right. Originally, I think in the 70s, it was Truck Distribution Service, which I did until...
They called Inland, I think Inland, wasn't it?
Right. And then later, starting about 1982, we had Inland Book Company and, you know, kind of East Coast version of Book People carrying, you know, a pretty broad range of literary and other kinds of books, including yours.
Yes. And those distributors allowed my books to get out there and be seen by a national audience. And I suppose one of the things, though, that I would like to emphasize it, is that it wasn't just the case of L.A. poets or where I was a Los Angeles-based editor only interested in L.A. poets and writers. There were poets elsewhere, like Lynn Roberts in Pennsylvania and Alicia Ostreicher in New Jersey and Jim Grabill, who was in Ohio first but then moved to Oregon, and Jim Moore and Trish Hample in Minnesota. These were all individuals that I published in my magazine, and several of those I went on to publish a book of their work. And it wasn't just individual like connections. I think so often people can think, well, you knew Paul personally and you like the person. I never met Lynn Roberts. He died about 10 years ago, and to this still haven't met Jim Grabill, even though he's just, 600, 700 miles away up north. It was just the work on the page that got me interested in and made me want to commit to doing a project with him.
But even though you published writers who were not from L.A., you still were integrally related. I mean, I think the Los Angeles literary community was your base, you know, and you're identified with it, of course.
Oh, yeah, it was absolutely my base. And I think it's really hard to separate what people maybe think about what I did from the LA scene. And in point of fact, let's say, well, how did I happen to meet Alicia Ostreicher at a very early stage in her career? Well, she happened to be in town because her husband was working at the Jet Propulsion Lab. And so she showed up at where so many poets showed up. She showed up at Beyond Baroque Workshop. And Jim Crusoe immediately took note of her work because of its quality and mentioned to her that she should send some poems to my magazine. And so I published some of that work, and it took off from there. And that's how I ended up publishing the Mother Child Papers, which was then reprinted by Beacon Press and via Pittsburgh Press, I'm proud to say. So that book has really lasted, and it's one of the one of the books I'm most proud of in terms of how it has remained a part of the cultural conversation. But I suppose that's just it. I'm identified with not just LA, but I'm identified with this place that was founded in 1968 by George Jerry Smith called Beyond Baroque. I'm not just identified. I've recently joined their board of directors, so I'm there still involved in a very practical way in the LA scene. I live and work down in Long Beach, which is about a 45 minute drive south of Los Angeles. For those who don't know the LA area very well.
Are there any good days on the highway anymore in LA?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Sunday morning at about 7:30, you can really speed along. I mean, there isn't much traffic at all.
Right.
You know, around. It all depends on when you're going and what direction. For instance, heading north from here about 5 in the afternoon isn't that bad. It's going the other direction that's really terrible.
Right.
So what you want to do is just try to time your trips, which can be really difficult to do at times. But I recently saw a survey. It said, yes, Los Angeles has the worst traffic in the world. And I would, in general, have to agree with it, agree with that evaluation. But, I evolved with Beyond Baroque, and it's sort of extraordinary how that place has survived. It nearly folded a couple times back in the 1990s, and of course it almost folded back in the mid 80s, only to be saved by a benefit concert by the band X. But it's kept going and still has a free Wednesday night workshop. For anybody who happens to be in LA on Wednesdays, you can drive over to Beyond Baroque and be part of a workshop that has its origins back in the late 60s and early 70s. And it's the place where I met people like Jim Crusoe and Harry Northup, Kate Braverman. Wanda Coleman was part of that workshop. Paul Vangelisti dropped in occasionally in the early days. I'm told that Tom Waits swung by there one night and before he had much in the way of records out and stood up and snapped his fingers and recited some poetry, but I wasn't there that night.
And it was Dennis Cooper involved in that or what?
The thing is, I sort of made my contacts there. By 1974, I pretty much had stopped attending the workshop, and in fact a group of us formed our own workshop. Lee Hickman and Jim Crusoe, Harry Northup, Dennis Ullman, Kate Braverman, and myself, along with Peter Levitt, met every other week for about a year and a half, and we just met in each other's houses, apartments, and so like I said, I hardly needed a MFA workshop when I had that crew around. So I didn't have much contact with the workshop, so I don't know if it started showing up in the late 70s attending readings, and one of the first times I remember him was a reading he gave at a bookstore I was working at called Intellectuals and Liars in the late 70s, and it was quite a good reading, and he sent me some poems for Momentum in the late 70s, I remember. And so we started corresponding, and of course his magazine Little Caesar really became the magazine in Los Angeles in the late 70s and early 1980s. And he took over the reading series in 1980, and with the help of more money being available, really made the reading series something that began attracting even larger, steady crowds and got more attention for Beyond Baroque than it really ever had before.
I guess we should probably mention for people who are listening who may not know the geography that Beyond Baroque is in Venice, which is kind of the farthest west community that you can be in Los Angeles. You know, sort of near, just below Santa Monica.
Right. Yeah. It's Venice is where a beat scene flourished. Many people tend to associate, when they think of the beat generation, they'll think San Francisco, North Beach, Greenwich Village, and they forget that there was a very large contingent of beat writers in Venice, and so many in fact that a literary hustler named Lawrence Lipton decided to write a book called The Holy Barbarians about them, and it was a national bestseller. So Venice West was pretty well known in its day. By the mid-60s, that whole scene had completely disintegrated, and there was really nothing left. So there was sort of this period between 65 and 68 where Venice was really in a holding pattern, at least in a poetry sense. And then George Drury Smith started Beyond Baroque, and a whole separate scene from that beat scene grew up. In truth, a lot of us were sort of so young that we really weren't aware of what had come before us. I must say, with some sense of being abashed, we actually sort of thought we were the first. Far from it. Although I was aware of Stuart Perkoff and knew John Thomas and admired his work quite a lot, I had no idea of the actual significance that their scene had had in its heyday in the late 50s. I mean, I wasn't even 12 years old when that scene was really flourishing, so, and I was not living in this area. So, but the scene that that grew up in around Beyond Baroque sort of put Venice back on the map as a poetry center. Now, of course, I assume you realize how gentrified Venice has become. It's unrecognizable as the community that I knew 40 years ago.
Yeah, it is clear. Yeah, I think the change in Los Angeles and the Venice area is certainly extreme. I was going to ask you about that a little bit, too, in that, you know, it seems that back in that time when L.A. was smaller, even though it was still geographically far flung, that the, you know, that Venice scene could more readily become the focus and the central focus for lots of other people in Los Angeles, so that, you know, people were not seemingly as challenged by travel as they would be today. It seems like now, I'm guessing, I don't know the Los Angeles literary community very well, but I would presume that it's more far flung and less able to be focused on any one place. You might have, you know, people in West Hollywood would never go to Silver Lake, and people who are in Pasadena will never come to Venice. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The challenge in getting around such a densely packed city is such that the decentralization, actually, I would say, started by the late 80s. In part, it was just, I would say, there was a couple things that happened. One is that after Dennis Cooper left in 84, there was a move at Beyond Baroque to emphasis on prose and fiction writers. Beyond Baroque is mainly associated with poetry, and it was for the first 15 or so years. But then, as with the culture in general, I think there was less interest in poetry in the more conservative half of the 80s, as Reaganism took hold. And it wasn't until the 90s that Beyond Baroque began, or mid-90s even, that Beyond Baroque began sort of taking up the cause of poetry again. in part, there's a fellow named Fred Dewey, sort of took over when everybody else had sort of given up. There really wasn't anybody who wanted to keep the doors open. And this fellow, Fred Dewey, decided that he was going to somehow do it one way or the other and single-handedly managed to pull that off for just long enough so that Beyond Baroque could sort of regain its feet. His main interest was poetry, so Beyond Baroque then began, has since then mainly focused on poetry. But in the late 80s, when Beyond Baroque sort of gave up its interest in being really a poetry place, this presented an opening for a lot of smaller communities in L.A., who were driving all the way over to Venice, right, to start their own reading series and their own communities of poetry. And so there's been a massive decentralization since then. And now you have like a place downtown. There's a place in Chinatown in downtown Los Angeles called the Poetic Read Bureau, and it's a little storefront buried back about 150 feet from the street. It's not even that easy to find. But it's, I've been there and I've really enjoyed the presentations I've seen there. And, so you have quite a diverse scene now that's all over the place, and all over the entire county and crosses into other counties up in Ventura County. There's a fairly vibrant poet starting its stir. So yeah, I think the decentralization is a major part of the story. It's not something that I particularly addressed in this book I wrote called Holdouts, which covers the period from 1948 to 1992. In a sense, I thought I had to draw a line somewhere, and I'm not really an expert in the poetry of L.A. after, say, 92. In some ways, I feel like somebody who was in rock and roll in the 70s. And at a certain point, you can no longer keep up with the current bands, right? So I'm sure there's lots of interesting poets in the LA area now. I'm not aware of them. That's the price of age.
Well, and also just because things are in fact no longer as centralized, you know, that there is this kind of incredible growth of diversity and different kinds of writing and geographical mm-hmm. centers, you know, a broader range of places.
There's also not the bookstores. You know, David, I can't go to a bookstore and then just find books by all from all these different communities. It's not like there's one place that I just easily stand and just pull books off the shelf and start to get a sense of what's happening. Since everything is on the internet, either things don't break down easily into, if you will, regional clusters. They don't tend to. So it's not like you can that there's some central site that you can go to and goes, the new LA poets. You know, the search engines don't organize themselves that way, or it's hard for us to sort of, and there just isn't the interest on other people of doing that kind of organization. So I would say knowledge in a weird way is both collected and refracted in a completely through completely different filters now, and it's not necessarily the way I'm most comfortable with accessing knowledge.
Well, no, in fact, it's interesting. I was going to ask you about the bookstores, so it's kind of congruent that you brought them up. I think that I think I hadn't thought about it in precisely that way, but I think the independent bookstores did stand as a kind of physical location for a gathering of and dissemination of poets around a kind of physical place that clearly has changed. But maybe you could talk a little bit about all the LA bookstores that were important to you, you know, in those years. That would be good to know about.
Well, yeah, first, of course, a certain way, although one might expect me to say Papa Bach, one of the stories that was most important to me was down in Hermosa Beach, which was about on my little Honda 100cc motorcycle that could only go on surface streets, was about a 40-minute drive down Pacific Coast Highway, but it was a fantastic store. It had little magazines from all over the country. I mean, that's where I found Patricia Hampels and Jim Moore's The Lamp and the Spine magazine. I found copies of Greg Kuzma's Pebble magazine. I mean, all these what we believe for many people are obscure, they had at the store, and they had an extraordinary poetry section. So I would often just drive down there on like a weekend where I was off from work, and I would spend all day just sort of hunched on the floor and then walk out of there with a small selection of purchases. It was a major resource for me.
What was the name of that store?
It was Either Or, with a slash mark between the either and the or. And I get the impression that they probably got their title from something that Kierkegaard wrote, although I'm not sure about that. There was a story, by the way, about this store that they didn't have a phone for many years. That they got into some kind of quarrel with the phone company about the bill. And the phone company said to them, well, you know, look, if you don't pay the bill, we're going to cut your phone off. Go ahead, cut our phone off. And they said, well, you can't survive without a phone. And they said, well, just watch. And so they didn't have a phone for years. And they still flourished. I mean, that's how good a store it was. And I think speaks of the kind of interest in writing that existed in L.A. in the 1970s. You had that kind of cantankerousness on the part of culture, of those who were interested in literary culture. And they would just, you know, spit in the face of the corporations. And, of course, then there was Papa Bach, a bookstore, which was a pun on paperback, right? And the owner liked to play music by Bach, and he sold mainly paperback. So Papa Bach, paperback bookstore.
Right.
They had that magazine, Bachy, B-A-C-H-Y, which I was the first poetry editor of, and then was edited by John Harris, who became eventually the owner of the store, and Leland Hickman, who took over the magazine for the last 9 or 10 issues before starting his own magazine, Tumblr. Then there was a person who worked as a clerk at Papa Bach Bookstore in the early 70s named William Iwamoto, who went across town and founded Chatterton's Bookstore Avenue, and that became one of the best places to give readings and to sell your poetry books. In more of the central part of West L.A., you had Sisterhood Bookstore and another bookstore run by a woman named Charlotte Gousset called George Sand Bookstore. And then there were just any number of others. There were, of course, Romans and later Dutton's were stores that were really interested in poetry and had readings and very good collections. For one reason or another, you just ended up with places that poets would work at, and the owners were so charmed by their personalities or whatever that they gave them carte blanche with the poetry sections. And for instance, there was a poet named Scott Wanberg who worked at Dutton's, who was fairly famous for working there. And because of this effusive personality, people came in and just sort of basically talked to him for a few minutes, and then he'd start walking around the store, and he'd say, you know, just here, hold this, and they'd walk out with $150 worth of books, and then they'd back for more because they realized he had this uncanny ability to know what they needed to read. Scott was a very good poet himself, and there was this whole period in L.A. where we had really terrific, a really terrific bookstore scene. Then there was another store called Intellectuals and Liars in Santa Monica, which was quite good for a couple of years. As you probably remember, there were the various chains that came in, and rents started going up. The thing people don't necessarily remember about LA in the 70s is that for a big city, it was still fairly cheap. But then, and I don't mean this come across as the way it might, but then a lot of people from back east started moving here. In particular, I remember in the early 80s, I started noticing a lot of New York license plates. and in other words, it was just the population began exploding. And that put pressure on rents everywhere, both apartments and businesses. And bookstores couldn't afford the rent. And over the years, one by one, the bookstores did. So now the presence of a chain store like Barnes & Noble is seen as a victory for the community. It's quite odd to see something like that be kind of be seen as a sign of the survival of literate culture. But such are the times. Such is the outcome of economic pressures.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about Momentum Press, just sort of how many books did you publish every year, and how long did you keep going before you quit being a poetry publisher? You know, when did it start? When did it end?
Well, it started technically with some books in 1975, if I remember correctly. To give you an idea about, let's all interweave it with the bookstores again. It was in the back room of Papa Bach. Was this huge poetry section at the rear of the store. They had several of a little inner room of a back room stocked with poetry. And I was back there one afternoon, and I struck up a conversation with a poet, and we immediately got into a friendly argument about a particular poet, and it turned out that we were neighbors in Ocean Park. Peter Levitt was his name, and we became pretty good friends. And I ended up, in fact, publishing a small book of it wasn't quite a chapbook, since it was perfect bound, but it was simply a long poem. So let's put it this way, that a long minimalist poem and called Two Bodies, Dark Velvet. And so I started publishing around 75, and I probably at my height only put out 3-4 books a year. In the end, I only maybe produced about two dozen titles, which is a really small number of books. But for whatever reason, and I've only recently begun to understand this. Let me back up here. For a long time, I could never understand why Momentum Press got as much attention as it seemed to get, given that I'm writing that many books. Red Hill Press, for instance, that was run by Paul Evangelisti and John McBride, put out 3 or 4 times the number, maybe 5-6 times the number of books I did. And so I was always glad that Momentum Press got a lot of attention and reviews, but I can never figure out why it to the number of books I was putting out that I would get this attention. And it's only recently that it's finally hit me that for whatever reason, I managed whatever book I printed was something that really had an impact. And the poets that I published tended to develop visible careers in some way. For instance, around 76, when I 77, when I decided to publish Holly Prado's Feast, that book really caught people's attention and boosted Holly into enough recognition that she could really begin making a living as a leading her own private workshops. And so there was, and of course, in leading those workshops, she talked about my aunt and what my publication of Feast had meant to her. And so there was this way that when I went on to publish Jim Crusoe and Kate Braverman and Lee Hickman, that and Joseph Hansen, these were all people who either continued developing careers or these are people who just simply continued. And so I suppose that one of the things that marks my presses is that the titles I put out were early examples of long careers, or of people whose work became visible in some way on a literary level. I'm not saying that. Obviously, there were other small presses at the time that also published people who kept going. But there were an awful lot of presses that, let's face it, David, who published a fair number of books, and you look at that and go like, well, whatever happened to this writer, right? And so I suppose that would be one of the things that I'd have to comment on in terms of what I did and that which makes me happy I did the work, because it's sort of has possessed a staying power. After I got my PhD, I moved to Long Island, and I was working in New York between around 2004 and 2005, and I went into the Poets' House, and I met the person who was running it, Steve Motika, and he asked me, well, is there anybody in L.A. who's sort of been forgotten that deserves to be reprinted? And I said to him, well, Lee Hickman. And within a couple of years, Stephen Tika's Nightboat books had become the co-publisher of the collected poems of Lee Hickman. So there is this way that the work that I put out wasn't just ephemeral or fashionable for the moment. It's kept going. It's hard to say that without sounding like you're bragging, but on the other hand, I suppose I do have to speak up, as I did at the time, for the value of the work I believed in, and I believe that it's proven to have enduring value. And will continue to do so.
Oh, I think that's true. And I think also the anthologies that you did also contributed to that, to the kind of both to the press's visibility and also to the community's visibility, you know, by creating that kind of grouping that established a scene, essentially.
Yeah, that is probably the other thing that made my press distinct. Red Hill put out all these other books, and Little Caesar was certainly very productive for a while. But Dennis, the anthology of younger poets called Coming Attractions, it wasn't necessarily featured or focused on L.A. The anthology, I did two anthologies, one in 1978, and then a much bigger one in 1985. 1985 is a really interesting year in terms of American poetry anthologies. You have, on one hand, Ron Silliman's incredibly important anthology of language poets, In the American Tree. And then from the mainstream, you have the Morrow anthology of younger American poets, which epitomizes the sort of MFA culture that was metastasized is the only word for it from my point of view in American literature. And for the Lyrics, who were represented in my anthology, Poetry Loves Poetry. And all this happened in 1985, in 1 year, these three anthologies. And I think they represent a kind of spectrum of what was happening in American poetry at the time. Mainstream academic baby boomer poets who were jostling to establish their supremacy. The avant-garde wing, represented by the language poets, which a term, by the way, that gets used later by Steve Cowart, few years later for another anthology he did called just simply The Maverick Poets. So in speaking for, and in fact, there were a couple of poems in my anthology, Poetry Loves Poetry, that appeared in Andre's, one in particular by Amy Gersler called Boy George. And so I was really pleased to sort of see that continuity there of poets and poems. So, and in certain ways, that kind of division still, I think, runs pretty strongly. I think there's this mainstream, and by now the AWP and what's called the Association of Writing Programs organization, the equivalent of the MLA, Modern Language Association for Creative Writers. And the AWP represents one very large faction of American poetry, and there's this avant-garde section, and then there are all these poets that really don't fit in anywhere and that are constitute a kind of maverick school. Which was first described in L.A., believe it or not. There was this poet named Mel Weisbird, recently died in L.A., who, along with Gene Frumkin, argued back starting in the 1950s that whereas people were characterizing American poetry as the raw versus the beat versus straight, they were breaking it down into these binaries. And Frumkin and Weisbird were arguing that, hold on here, there's you're leaving this kind of dichotomy may be the easiest, but it doesn't provide any account of all of us who have chosen a third way, who are neither of the star of a direct flagrant rebellion. So they emphasize the sense, and here in Los Angeles, this is where this faction sort of took root, and in many ways, I think what they started ended up being part of the approach that many of us took in the 70s in Los Angeles, and whether I realized it or not, had an impact on my poetics as an editor and publisher.
Well, it's a pretty nice way to summarize. I think I like that kind of. The way you've just placed it. And I think I really want to thank you for talking about momentum and the history of, what amounts to the history of LA, or at least a segment of history of LA poetry and publishing. So thanks for doing this, Bill.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to spend some time thinking about people and poets who's worth a great deal of affection for and allegiance to. And there are many other people to talk about, of course, but that's for another occasion.
Thanks, Bill. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing. This is David Wilk, your host, and I've been talking to Bill Moore about Momentum Press and Momentum Magazine.